really noticed that hitters have gotten away from this idea of hitting the ball on the ground. Like, I think every kid who played Little League probably had some, you know, plumber or electrician or whoever was coaching your team was like, ah, I read in a book 60 years ago, swing down on the ball, that'll work. Even though, like, the basic concept of physics is, like, hitting down on the ball is bad. But every kid in the world learns, like, hit down on the ball, chop wood. And now I think, like, major league hitters have realized, like, this is stupid. You know what really happens when I, like, swing really hard and hit it in the air? It goes really far and we get a lot of runs.
This episode was filmed live in Boston at the Wilbur. We'll be taking the show on the road this summer with shows in San Francisco in August, Chicago in September, and Toronto again in September. Check us out at pitchtalksbaseball.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at pitchtalks.
My name is Jonah Carey. I guess I'm the MC tonight, token Canadian. By the way, I am wearing a Pedro Martinez tie. That is Pedro Martinez on the tie. Because he's, look at that. That gentleman knows it's a common denominator, of course, between my beloved Montreal Expos and your beloved Boston Red Sox. There's a gentleman in the audience. It's hard to see. His name is Aaron Dana. I believe it's aarondana.com. He made this design, and he's really cool, and he's done all kinds of cool Celtic stuff and Red Sox stuff and all that. So if you like it, aarondana.com, because my thing is all about promoting other people's stuff. I'm, like, pathological that way. Anyway. So we have a bunch of cool panels, and I guess we'll get started on the first one. Let us bring out our guests. First of all, he is the managing editor for Fangraphs.com. It is Dave Cameron. Was that an Arkells tune? Very nice. Arkells, by the way, see, I'm just going to do this all night long. Arkells, an amazing Canadian band, which you should totally get all their music. Okay, next. Also from Fangraphs.com, the esteemed Paul Swiden. And finally, a guy I met 5 minutes ago who seems really, really cool. He runs an outfit called Chat Sports, which is actually a really neat app. It is James Yoder. Is Alex on this panel too? Hey, we'll let Alex come in too. He writes for the Boston Globe, but it's really awesome. Alex Speer. Sorry, buddy.
Thanks for the afterthought, Joe.
Hey, I already fucked up. That's awesome. No, yeah, we'll just see if Alex just stays there and sees what happens. So the panel is nominally a discussion, I guess, of analytics. And each of these four gentlemen has a background, I guess, in a little bit of a different way. And I think that maybe one way to start is to talk about kind of the intersection of analytics and convincing people to use it and get into it and adopt it as sports fans. And so we could start with James, and then we'll kind of move from there. Chat Sports, which you showed me on your phone, which looks really cool. The basic idea is you're trying to follow, let's say, the Red Sox, and you're trying to figure it out, and you punch up your phone, it's got everything there, and you just kind of go from there. You know, what is the engine that drives that kind of thing, and how do we make communication and analytical thinking kind of blend together?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, just a quick plug for our product. I'm not the biggest Red Sox fan. I live in San Francisco.
Boo.
I found out in 45 seconds all the stuff I need to know about the Red Sox in 20 seconds scrolling through our app. I hit MLB, Red Sox. I found out we acquired a guy, Hill, from the Brewers in 2 seconds, so it was good. So, you know, what we've tried to figure out as a company through analytics in general, it's a little different than what baseball teams or players will use, is how we can get people to consume content consistently. And make it more about retention. So when we think about analytics from a sports media company, it is about how can we deliver the best content to someone at the exact right time to get them to not only consume it, but go to the next article. So a lot of things that we take into account when we personalize a sports news product for someone is how long is a headline and how does that make a difference if someone will click or not click? How long is an article? Is it 200 words or 2,000 words? And do people engage with that? Is it an article from a blog, a national source, a local newspaper? And we're curating this content. And so what we've done is we take all these 40 different data points for each individual user and say, of all the pieces of content out there on the internet, what is the most likely that this one user, when they press that icon on their phone, is going to delight their experience? And for a Red Sox fan, it's a trade from from the Brewers, so we want to make sure that that's not being buried beneath some Bruins off-season content that's not as relevant.
I know all the people here were really excited about the Aaron Hill trade, right? You're like, well, how do I get more delightful Aaron Hill content?
Of course.
So, Dave, you've been writing about baseball with an analytical bent, going back to the USS Mariner days. The first time I met Dave was in Tacoma, Washington. It was
2003.
He looked like Jesus Christ. That's the only way that I could say it.
It was my only attempt in history to try and grow a beard.
Wow, it went poorly.
6 months of, like, not shaving, and I looked very homeless.
And you were on the forefront. You were one of the people writing about this stuff early. And it's interesting. I mean, now it seems like it's accepted. I mean, it's become more mainstream. How do you make that happen? How do you write about things in a way that's compelling, but, you know, it flatters the reader, but it doesn't overwhelm them and it doesn't belittle them or whatever?
Yeah, I think the big change I've made from when I started writing about kind of analytics is that I used to really try and push the numbers, right? Like, one of the main things I used to do is be like, I'm going to teach you this really new metric. You need to stop using OPS and start using WOBA because it's like 3% better, right? So, like, I was trying
no,
to...
No. 2%
better. 2% better, of course. Yeah, my bad. It's royalty checks on the way.
Continue.
So I think I've moved away from that and thinking that the numbers themselves actually matter all that much and seen it as much more of an attempt to find the right stories to tell. Like, we can tell the true stories. That's all I really care about. I don't actually care if on TV the broadcasters are telling you OPS or WOBA or WRC+. It doesn't really matter as long as they're telling you, like, David Ortiz is good and Matt Kemp sucks, right? Like, as long as they get that right, like, if they're telling you Matt Kemp is good, we need to change the analytics they're using so they come to a different conclusion. But the conclusion is the really important one. So I've tried to move away from, like, let me teach you how to, you know, do the algorithms yourself or carry a calculator with you or, you know, whatever it is to, like, come up with the more accurate calculation. And let's just come up with, like, Mike Trout is amazing and Miguel Cabrera didn't deserve the MVP.
Wow. Miguel Cabrera is in the audience, by the way. You know that.
I can outrun him.
Oh. That was an interesting one, too. The other day I went on Twitter and I argued that, I think I put a poll up, who would win in a foot race, me or Bartolo Colon? And people 61 or something like that said Bartolo Colon. I totally agree. He's a professional athlete. We're not professional athletes. Could you outrun anybody in Major League Baseball, really?
Pablo Sandoval?
Yeah. Maybe for Prince Fielder.
Yeah. That's a low-hanging fruit with this crowd. Alex, you write for a large and mainstream newspaper, one that is rooted in a tradition of reporting and thought, and I don't want to say old school, but definitely, you know, kind of this very much a journalistic sort of place. And you are bringing, it's not necessarily that you're crunching numbers per se for the site, but you're bringing a little bit of a different approach. You know, how was that, especially when you started at the Globe and they came to you and they said, listen, we like your work, we think you're going to be good here. What was the discussion about, I'm going to infuse a little bit of this and a little bit of that? Or was there a discussion?
Yeah, I don't think there was that much of a discussion. I mean, the conversation has been steadily broadening over the course of, you know, over the course of the last 10 to 15 years. And what had been the outsider's perspective from a statistical and analytical standpoint, a lot of that language has just been folded in. And so I don't think that they saw me as being, there was a sense that the way in which I use numbers and kind of emphasize them represented a great complement to the great stuff that was already there. But I don't think that it was viewed as being like a drastic change of course from what had been done up to that point. Just instead someone who perhaps emphasized them a little bit more, and with the mindfulness, you know, with the mindfulness of exactly what Dave is talking about, namely that you're not trying to give a class. This is not constantly, you know, a baseball statistics, you know, 101 or God forbid 201 class. But instead, you're writing about freaking baseball, and everything that you say should be in the same language and in language that's easily distilled and, you know, and comprehended and welcomed by anyone so that you can just have a conversation. And maybe someone's going to disagree like hell with, you know, the way in which you present the information, but they can still get it and they can tell you why you're an idiot as opposed to just saying, you're probably an idiot.
Certainty is always a good thing. Paul, you are involved with Fangraphs. Fangraphs also a partner with Hardball Times. The Hardball Times annual is one of my favorite places just to read stories, to read narratives. It tells a great story in that way, but it is very much rooted in analytics. The basic question is, how do you tell a good story? How do you spin a longer yarn and make it something where people are both entertained, but they also learn from it?
So, I mean, I think there's a couple of different ways. One way that we've found in the past couple of years is to really focus on something very specific. Like one of our biggest articles this year was about the Doug Mirabelli trade, and it was literally a day in his life and how that all came to be. But if you can go really in depth on that, on a piece of baseball history, and there's endless pieces of baseball history, that's the best thing about baseball is we have so many different stories to tell, that if you can go in depth from a new perspective on that one piece, people are going to be interested in reading that. And the trick is trying to just to pick the best topics. And that's kind of the way I view it, is if you're picking good topics, people are going to be interested to read them. And it's not necessarily about you, the writer. It's more about what kind of story you're trying to tell.
My favorite part of that story is it's a day in the life of Doug Mirabelli, and the best part of that whole article was the story about Josh Beckett accidentally getting told he got traded when like Theo like texted the wrong Josh, and was like, Josh Beckett's like, I have an ERA of 2. You sure you traded me? Anyway, it's a really good article just for the Josh Beckett story alone. Go read it.
Theo is the best storyteller. We're going to talk Red Sox in a little bit with the following panel, but so we won't necessarily do a deep Red Sox conversation, but one guy who fascinates me is Stephen Wright. He's really good, first of all, and he's a knuckleballer. And it is just so rare to see knuckleballers come into the game, much less pitch this well. There are a lot of pros and cons about knuckleballing and how it can exist. One of the arguments is that there's not enough people to teach it. You've got Charlie Huff and Tim Wakefield. Sure, that's it. So
Candiotti.
Candiotti's a good one, too. So is it the kind of thing where can we teach this in the game? Can there be more Stephen Wrights, or is it just going to be very specific to whatever team Candiotti or Huff or whoever happens to be consulting for? And I'll throw it open to any of you guys.
I think I'll jump in. I think unquestionably, I don't understand why it hasn't been more widely experimented with. And I recognize that I think maybe that's a failing at the amateur level because all of the guys who do it really well have messed around with it at some point in their very distant past. And so, you know, it's something that's discouraged in Little League because God forbid that kids who are 9 years old should have fun and be creative. And instead of learning these mechanics that are meant to let them throw 95 miles an hour by the time they're 17 years old, get drafted, get $1 million, blow out by the time they're 19 and be in prison by 21, that they should learn to throw like with a creative delivery that, you know, that's meant to deceive people or with a pitch that's meant to defy physics and that is made and that renders useless some of the advanced statistical models that we use like pitch effects data. So I think the failing starts there. I do think it's coachable, but again, the failing is there because no one in that, you know, kind of cookie cutter template of how you teach pitching was learning how to throw good knuckleballs back then. So, you know, so you have kind of a negative funneling effect that leads you with just these little drips of knuckleballers, which is a damn shame.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about both Wakefield and Wright is that there was an element of desperation, right? They were both like, this was their last chance to be major leaguers, was if they could learn this one pitch. And it's like, there are hundreds of people that are desperate to be major leaguers every season. So it would seem that there's a real opportunity for that.
So I think the one thing that doesn't get talked about a ton of like why we don't have knuckleballers, more knuckleballers in baseball, is a knuckleballer actually costs you 2 roster spots, right? Because you need a knuckleball catcher. Right, so like you have to carry like a dedicated catcher just to catch this stupid pitch that he throws one day every 5, and this guy can never hit because all he does is one skill catching this one guy on the roster, and if that guy has like a bad outing and gets pulled in the third inning, now you have to take out your starting catcher and you're running a short bench. So I think there's actually a larger roster cost when you talk to managers. They don't want to carry 3 catchers. They don't want to carry a guy who can't pinch run or play the infield. And now that every team is like 17 man bullpens and you only have like one utility infielder covering the rest of the bench, I think it's really tough for teams to carry a backup catcher. So I think if you have a knuckleballer who's Tim Wakefield, or, you know, one of the guys who made it in the Hall of Fame, like Charlie Ruff, that's great. But if you have, you know, a Stephen Wright who may or may not be a good pitcher and may not keep this up forever, do you really want to carry a knuckleball catcher on your roster for maybe a back-end starter, a guy who's going to be up and down? If you can get an R.A. Dickey, absolutely, it's worth it. But I think most teams don't think they can do that, and they don't want to pay the catcher cost.
You know, the way I think about knuckleball pitchers, just to add to that a little bit, is how a dual-threat quarterback in football or a deep three-pointing shooter in basketball, they can change the game, but it really takes an organization to buy in for it. And we saw with the Golden State Warriors the last couple of years, they shoot threes at an absurd pace and percentage, and Michael Vick 15 years ago broke in the NFL, and people are like, oh, wow, you can run and pass. You can be one of the fastest guys. And so that's because you had maybe a talent that was an outlier in Curry and Vick. Maybe you need that as a knuckleballer. But also you had organizations that bought in and said, we are going to, you know, to hell or high water, we're with this guy. And I don't think you've ever seen that from an organization saying, we're going to have 2 or 3 knuckleballers on our roster and show it can be done.
By bringing up the Warriors, you've ripped open the wound of the Kevin Durant thing. It's still fresh. They're not ready for this. You can't be doing
that. I'm from Seattle.
Well, okay. I'm from Montreal. What's your point?
Well, this is like commiserate over here.
We'll commiserate. So let's get into orthodoxy a little bit in the game. In general, you know, we talk about knuckleballing. Stephen Wright is a great example for a success story. What stands out to you guys as maybe another story, a player, a tactic, a manager, something that's going on in baseball that you're like, oh, that's different, and it also seems to be working. It could be literally anything that's going on this season.
So I think my favorite thing I actually wrote about Josh Donaldson today, who's having another monster year, he's better than he was last year, is we've really noticed that hitters have gotten away from this idea of hitting the ball on the ground. Like, I think every kid who played Little League probably had some, you know, plumber or electrician or whoever was coaching your team was like, ah, I read in a book 60 years ago, swing down on the ball, that'll work. Even though, like, the basic concept of physics is, like, hitting down on the ball is bad. But every kid in the world learns, like, hit down on the ball, chop wood. And now I think, like, major league hitters have realized, like, this is stupid. You know what really happens when I, like, swing really hard and hit it in the air? It goes really far and we get a lot of runs. So you see, like, Daniel Murphy and, like, a lot of these guys, Matt Carpenter, who weren't necessarily pull hitters, they weren't fly ball guys, who have turned themselves into really great hitters by kind of throwing away the customary wisdom of, like, hitting down on the ball, hit ground balls, use the whole field. No. Pull the ball 450 feet down the left field line. Do what the Blue Jays are doing. The Blue Jays score 10 million runs a year. Like, Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion were onto something. And I think it's kind of fun to watch a kind of a generation of hitters figure out, like, okay, if all the pitchers are going to throw 104 miles an hour, we're going to try and hit it 450 feet instead of, like, spraying the ball around the field because our 75-year-old coach thinks it looks cool.
I'm not creative enough to have anything that would be as good as that, but I'll simply add to that. I talked to Mark Trumbo recently, who it was actually kind of fascinating. He was like, well, I don't like the word analytics because the analytics community hates me. But he nonetheless, this person who is treated as kind of being a caveman Luddite, he talked about how he had used StatCast as a means of turning himself to even more of a power hitter, recognizing what his strengths were and saying, exactly what you're talking about. Well, you know, he had this off-season hitting coach who explained to him, if your launch angle is this, then you have a chance to hit the ball 3,000 feet. If your launch angle is this, you're going to ground out every time. And so he kind of worked on where his contact point was as a result of that, ended up being even more focused on how he could improve his game. And to me, it's not really, it's not a single event that's better in baseball this year, so much as in ongoing fashion. The game changes not, you know, not one moment in, moment at a time, 1 month at a time, but instead over the course of kind of windows that change the dialogue about the game, and you know, in a really fascinating and interesting way.
And I'll say to pick up on Alex's point, I just like what Dan Duquette and the crew in Baltimore does with the Orioles every year, and they kind of pick up these guys. Trumbo is a perfect example this year. They pick up these guys that nobody wanted, like a couple years ago, no one wanted Nelson Cruz, and they just find these good hitters, and they manage to stack the lineup. And you look up in July, and they're in first place, and you say, "How? I can't name one pitcher on their team," but they're scoring so many runs that, for the most part, it doesn't matter. And that's kind of fun to watch because that's not generally how teams have been built the last 20 years.
All right, we want to give some time to the audience for questions before we get to the Red Sox panel. So I don't know if we have someone walking around with a mic or not. I can literally hand you my mic, or you could yell or whatever it is that you want to do. We do have a gentleman with a mic right over there. So if anybody has a question for any of our esteemed panelists, feel free to go for it. Do not be shy. You guys should be drinking more. Why are you not drinking more? By the time we get to Bill Lee, you'll be properly liquored up.
Blame ourselves. There was a green room conversation about whether or not we should be grabbing beers to bring out on stage. So
I just fill up with vodka instead.
Yeah. You're drinking it like it's water, though.
Yeah, no doubt.
That's a guy who's watched Hanley Ramirez play left field recently.
Oh. What are you doing? Why don't you just come in a Jeter jersey, for God's sake? What's going on?
I never know what I'm doing.
Do we have a question? I literally cannot see. Yes.
Hey, I wanted to talk about, because you guys were talking about why don't more pitchers use knuckleballs. There's the whole thing of, like, people don't do something desperate unless they are desperate, right? So two pitcher examples this season are Rich Hill and Matt Shoemaker, who both started using a whole bunch of curveballs and splitters because that's what they had to do in order to be any good or they were going to be out of the league. So I wonder if, like, either A, more pitchers will start doing that as they just start becoming bad and they know they're going to go to the minor leagues and just they should just start throwing curveballs more often, or is that just an anomaly that like just happened to be true for two pitchers?
Yeah, I think we're going to see in baseball, despite the huge rise in velocity over the last few years, the fastball is going to start to go away. I think if you look at the best pitchers in baseball, you can look through their careers. They almost all come up throwing like 60, 70% fastballs because that's what they were taught in the minor leagues, taught in high school, throw fastball, establish your fastball. And then they get to the big leagues and like, man, these guys can hit fastballs. Fastballs suck. And then they throw curveballs and sliders and they're amazing. Like Clayton Kershaw has like 17 breaking pitches that are better than any of his fastballs. And I think most of the best pitchers in baseball have figured out to live off their breaking stuff and just throw the fastball often enough in order to, you know, keep you honest, essentially, so you're not sitting on the breaking balls. So I think that eventually we're going to get to a point where teams realize this establish the fastball mantra is backwards. And all these guys who come over from Japan and throw splitters all the time, like the Koji Uehara way of pitching, works really well. And if you throw 87, it doesn't matter if you have this amazing splitter that no one can hit. So I think as we get kind of non-American influences who come over and pitch really well, we have Kenta Maeda in the Dodgers this year, I think we'll see baseball move that direction and the fastball will become less important and pitchers will learn to pitch off their breaking stuff more often.
And I'll just jump in since, you know, I talked a lot to Hill about how he changed, in part with the influence of the Red Sox director of pitching analysis and development, Brian Bannister, now the guy in uniform who's not Carl Willis. And he talked about how in a simple conversation with Brian Bannister, this guy who is a front office member with the Red Sox, he was kind of given the freedom to be creative. And at that time, there was an element of desperation, but it wasn't that so much as it was this window into how he could be really, really good. And I think that there's going to be a lot of reconsideration about usage and pitch mix that is driven by a change of thinking in Major League Baseball front offices as well, with people who are becoming more versed with some of the advanced statistics and analytics that would give you an insight into, okay, if you throw your curveball in, you know, if you have, actually a big part of their conversation between Hill and Bannister was about, this is how Clayton Kershaw uses breaking balls, and it's this percent of the time, it is not 3 out of every 10 pitches, you can do that too. What would happen if you did? And those conversations are going to become broader, which is going to open the door, hopefully, to more creativity and more of the resistance to the cookie cutter template that was referenced earlier.
Let's do a couple more questions. There's hands, several hands. Yep. Whoever is closer to the dude with the mic, I guess, gets the benefit.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a subject changer, but directed towards Alex mainly. Several months ago, your colleague Fluto Shinzawa, the hockey writer, discussed research in the NHL where NHL general managers were backing away from trade deadline trades, you know, to get rental players because he finding out that the cost and prospects in young players was just too much. So there's, you know, be less of those deals in hockey. Has there been any kind of parallel research in baseball about the effect, how good or the efficacy, that's the one word I can think of trade deadline deals in baseball?
Well, I think that I think that there's been kind of a there's been a general pendulum swing over the course of time where, you know, and in fact Dave Dombrowski has talked about maybe 5 or 8 years ago about how he, you know, how prospects had become overvalued, and he thought that, you know, there were opportunities to make deals, but no one was willing to include prospects in deals, which hindered their conclusion. In terms of formal study, from a trade value standpoint, I haven't seen anything comprehensive. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It probably means that I'm just myopic. But in terms of overall value of that it's ascribed to prospects, by say, you know, on average a prospect who's ranked X at, you know, this as the seventh best prospect in baseball by Baseball America has on average this future WAR or something like that in his career. You have seen some of that, and that sort of hard analysis does influence a lot of decision making in front offices. For instance, when the Red Sox made the decision to sign David Price, they did so because they did an analysis of the net present value of a number of their prospects, guys like Yoan Moncada, like Andrew Benintendi, to figure out, what's the real cost of acquisition if we trade for a front of the rotation starter? Does that exceed or does that fall short of $217 million over 7 years? And the answer, obviously, you know what they did.
I did do a piece last year where I looked at the cost of acquisition.
Sorry, I didn't read it.
Yeah, of course. I don't know why you would. It wasn't published in the Boston Globe. So I did a piece last year that basically showed that the acquisition cost at the deadline is roughly double what it is in the winter. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get a worse deal, but you're going to pay twice as much. The interesting thing, though, is you have more information, right? Like at this point, you know more about your playoff odds in July than you did in March. So you have a greater certainty that this guy that you trade for, say Andrew Miller or one of these guys, is going to pitch really well for you in an important playoff series. So there's an incentive to pay more that's not necessarily rational. You'd look at it and be like, well, it's the same player and I'm only getting him for half a season. Why would I pay twice as much? But you're getting him for, you're getting a larger percentage chance you're going to get him for those important games. And I think one of the things that we do probably as a disservice is we focus a lot on regular season stats and be like, this guy's a 3-win player, a 4-win player. But all we really care about is October, right? Or that's all the players really care about is like winning in the playoffs. And if you get a guy who can, you know, dominate for, you know, 2 out of 5 starts in a short series, that can have a huge impact on your playoff odds. So I think teams generally pay twice the price that you would pay in the winter in order to get a deadline acquisition. Whether that makes it not worth it or not, that's probably up to each individual team and how crazy their owner is.
And I will say just briefly, Jeff Zimmerman, who writes for us at Fangraphs and Hardball Times, has begun or has introduced research to evaluate these kinds of prospect trades based on how scouts rank the player as like a future value. So if they say he's a 50 future value player, then this is what you should expect in return for that player. So that's something that will build up over time, but it is something that we've begun.
We got time for one more question, I'm told, because the general manager of the Boston Red Sox, Mike Hazen, is here, so that's fun. Well, you know what? You're right in front, so I'm just going to give you the benefit, and you'll yell loud, and I can repeat the question.
Dave, you spoke earlier about knuckleball catchers and the roster crunch.
Yeah.
We saw the Cubs play pitchers in left field the other day. It seems like the roster crunch is more and more pitchers, and bullpens get bigger, becoming a bigger deal. How would you solve that?
So the question is about roster crunch and the fact that like bullpens are taking over so no one has a bench anymore. So I think what's going to happen in the CBA negotiations that are happening right now is eventually the players are going to figure out a way to convince the owners to expand the rosters with some kind of taxi squad. The owners are kind of against this because they don't want to pay more players the major league minimum and escalate their salaries. But I think we're going to get to a point where now you have so many guys who have, you know, nagging injuries who can't play for 3 or 4 days, but they don't want to put them on the DL for 2 weeks necessarily. So teams are playing shorthanded. So I think the Players Association is going to find some way, whether it's saying taxi squad guys get, you know, half the league minimum, or they're going to come up with some kind of system that says now you have 27 players and you get to choose the 25 that are active any given day. So if you've got a guy who, like, you know, went out and smoked a bunch of weed last night and he can't play today, but I can't tell the media that, hey, this guy's unavailable because he has flu-like symptoms.
We call that living in Colorado.
Okay? Yeah, right. Hey, I'm moving to Oregon. So I think we'll see kind of some kind of expansion of that because the players would appreciate some more days off and not necessarily feel like they're letting their teams down. And I think teams want an opportunity to be able to carry more diverse rosters and be able to experiment and not have to play Pedro Strop in left field. I will say, though, from friends in Chicago, Pedro Strop apparently was, like, making the most of it. He was, like, aligning the defense in left field. And, like, he was calling for shifts. And, like, so I think if we had more Pedro Strops, I'd be all for putting pitchers in the outfield.
I would say that, you know, someone should ask the same question to Mike when he talks, and the answer would probably be pair Brock Holt with, you know, Aaron Hill or something like that. But clearly, you know, there's the rise in, you know, the Zobristing of rosters in baseball is a direct outgrowth of the growth of bullpens and in that very roster crunch that you're speaking of. So, yeah, cultivating those guys who are able to play all over the place. Maybe that's pitchers too. Maybe that is an inefficiency. Like a guy who comes up as a two-way player, you know, maybe the future is that guy who was a two-way high school player who can continue to do both things once he gets to...
And throw the knuckleball. He should also have to throw the knuckleball.
Finally.
The answer to all the world's problems is Brooks Kieschnick, ladies and gentlemen. You heard it here first. Thank you to Dave and to Paul and to James and to Alex. And we'll be back in a minute.